Verizon and its plans for media domination. From Marketplace in New York, I'm Molly Wood, in for David Brancaccio. This is the Midday Update. A Wall Street Journal report today says Verizon will bid $3 billion for Yahoo's web assets. That business includes Yahoo's various websites and search business and a few other properties. Eric Gordon is a professor with the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Eric, give us a sense of what Verizon wants here.
Good morning, Molly. Verizon wants two things. It wants eyeballs, and it wants the technology tools to match the eyeballs to advertisers. You know, as a company, it's a mess, but a lot of people still go to Yahoo sites. The trick is to turn the eyeballs into money, and to do that, you need technology tools that match those eyeballs to the advertisers, and it's the advertisers who end up paying you.
So now, is $3 billion, though, a lot for these? Aren't these the assets that were valued at essentially zero?
Yeah, so it's interesting. At one point, these assets were valued at some negative number. It turns out that when you take these assets outside of Yahoo and put them in somebody else's hands, they do have some value, although the value has gone down in the last month.
So let's talk a little bit more about Verizon, which has become sort of an ever-present name in media acquisitions. What other moves have they made lately?
Well, you know, they bought AOL, another fallen giant. They bought it last year for about $4.4 billion, so they could be doubling down. So Verizon clearly is very committed to building out sort of this across-the-line media business, including internet and internet advertising.
That's Eric Gordon from University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you.
Prescription pain medications are becoming an American epidemic. Nearly 19,000 Americans died in 2014 from overdoses. And of course, Prince is just the latest high-profile death. And now the FDA, states, and health insurance companies are trying to solve the problem. A new report suggests that a key strategy is data. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
One reason prescription painkiller abuse has gotten out of hand is that it's super easy to get a script. It's called doctor shopping.
Like they go to multiple doctors and get the same, you know, prescriptions at high risk for abuse.
That's Cornell Health Policy Professor Yuhua Bao and lead author of the report. Bao and her colleagues found that one way to stop this kind of shopping is when doctors sign up for systems that track the pharmacies where people are buying these drugs.
Without such a kind of a system-wide database, it would be hard for individual doctors to really see the complete picture.
The take-home, says Bao, is that when docs can see that complete picture, these programs lead to a 30% drop in prescribing certain opioids. Every little bit helps, especially given that 259 million opioid prescriptions were written in 2012, more than enough for every American adult. Health insurers are also betting on data to help this problem. Anthem can see its members who go to multiple pharmacies and use scripts from multiple docs.
They're in panic often.
Anthem case manager Emily McKay takes calls from many of these people from around the country.
You know, I've got to get in somewhere. I've got to get medications. Or it may be, can you talk to my doctor and let them know I'm really in pain?
This month, Anthem launched a program to funnel people it considers at high risk for opioid abuse to just one pharmacy. Anthem is just one of several insurers trying to get its hands around the problem. Cigna's Dr. Doug Nemasek says his company is sharing data to try and figure out what sorts of treatment programs work best to break these addictions. Up until now, he says, that's a code that hasn't been cracked.
The biggest issue that we have is that we don't know how to help people choose the best program for them, and we don't know how to measure quality for the programs that are providing care today.
Add Nemasek to the long list of healthcare people who are putting their faith in data to help us pull through this crisis. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Job growth may have stalled, but American consumers are spending pretty well these days, although they are borrowing more to pay for it. After years of paying down balances and living frugally after the Great Recession, debt is apparently back in style. In March, consumer credit was up 10% over the previous year. Later today, the Federal Reserve reports on debt for April. It's likely to be, yep, up again. From the Marketplace desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
You may not be getting a mailbox full of card offers promising low APR, free bonus miles, like in the loose credit days of the early 2000s, but consumers are now more willing to put purchases on plastic.
Credit card debt is the highest since August of 2009.
Analyst Matt Schultz at creditcards.com says that's driven by Americans' increasing confidence that their jobs will stick around for a while.
Delinquencies are still very low. We haven't really reached any tipping point in consumers not being able to handle the debt that they have. But if it keeps climbing too high too quickly, that probably isn't too far off.
Young people aren't racking up credit card debt because of student debt, says Chris Christopher at IHS.
The jobs are not paying that great. They move back into the house and then they have this big debt overhang. They are more cautious.
Student debt now tops $1.3 trillion, up about 40% since 2011. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In Scotland today, a hearing on a proposed law that would set a mandatory minimum price for alcohol. The thinking is that by raising the price of some liquor, the government could help curb excessive drinking. And the global liquor industry is watching closely. The BBC's Reval Alderson, Scottish Home Affairs correspondent, is in Glasgow with more. Reval, give us a sense of what this law is hoping to accomplish.
Well, this was a law that was passed 4 years ago by the Scottish Parliament. And the idea was to try to improve Scotland's fairly abysmal health record in relation to alcohol and to cut consumption, particularly of high-strength ciders and vodkas, which are often priced at the lowest end of the market. So the idea was that by putting a minimum price for a unit of alcohol, which the government has now fixed at 50 pence per unit of alcohol, that would price some of these cheaper, more toxic substances out of the market and tackle the health problems. But it has been mired for the past 4 years in legal problems.
Can you give me an example of the price hike? How significant is that?
In terms of these very high-strength ciders, which are beloved by certain people, I think the price would almost double. That means that if you're on a budget and basically wanting to drink to get drunk, it's going to be much more difficult to do that. So the idea is that they are targeting the government a certain section of society and a certain type of drink. And I think that is what the Scotch Whisky Association, which has taken this matter to court, is arguing against.
Well, we know that the alcohol industry is watching this court ruling very closely. What is the potential for global precedent?
Oh, well, I don't know what the potential for a global precedent is, but certainly if the Scottish government gets away with this, then it could have a deleterious effect on the drinks industry worldwide if other governments followed suit. The precedent having been set, it might be up to individual governments to say, right, we're going to target this particular drink or that particular drink, and that would cause a major readjustment for the market in that country. And of course, and this is what the Scotch Whisky Association is arguing, is that it could therefore damage their exports into other countries, which is very significant value to the Scottish economy.
That's the BBC's Reval Alderson. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Lawyers don't get a lot of sympathy when it comes to questions of salary, but you will be interested to know that base salaries for junior lawyers have not gone up in a decade. Until now, one of the legal industry's most elite firms just announced that it will up first-year lawyer salaries from $160,000 to $180,000. Other firms are likely to do the same, but the lawyers won't have to live on that for long. Partners at Cravath, Swain & Moore, which made the move, earned an average of $3.5 million each last year. I'm Molly Wood with the Marketplace Midday Update from American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.